Coming up next on Passion Struck. For years, I asked myself the exact same question. Who do I want to become? Recently, I've realized I've been asking the wrong question all along. The question that changes everything isn't who you want to become. It's this: who benefits if I never evolve? Welcome to Passion Struck. I'm your host, John Miles. This is the show where we explore the art of human flourishing and what it truly means to live like it matters. Each week, I sit down with changemakers, creators, scientists, and everyday heroes to decode the human experience and uncover the tools that help us lead with meaning, heal what hurts, and pursue the fullest expression of who we're capable of becoming. Whether you're designing your future, developing as a leader, or seeking deeper alignment in your life, this show is your invitation to grow with purpose and act with intention. Because the secret to a life of deep purpose, connection, and impact is choosing to live like you matter. Hey, it's your friend John. Over the past few weeks, we've been exploring what it really means to flourish. Becoming more present. Rewiring the way we respond to life. Building environments that grow us instead of keeping us stuck. But somewhere in the middle of putting these episodes together, I realized we've all been circling a question we hadn't actually asked out loud. Not who do I want to become? We all asked that one. The one I can't shake now is different. Who benefits if I never evolve? At first, the answer seems obvious. Me. If I neglect my health, I pay for it. If I never deal with my anxiety, that's my weight to carry. If I stay stuck in old habits, old stories, old wounds, I'm the one who lives with it. Or am I? Here's the assumption I never stopped to check, that our inner life belongs only to us, that stress is private, our fears are private, our healing is private. What if none of that is true? Here's the claim I want to make today, and everything else in this episode is just going to prove it. Every human being is an environment, not a person with an environment, an environment. Your kids don't just live in a house with you, they live inside your nervous system. Your team doesn't just work under you, they work inside your weather. Your family doesn't just experience your intentions, they experience your presence. Your team doesn't inherit your goals, they inherit your emotional state. That single idea has quietly rewired how I think about ambition, success, leadership, even the private work of healing. Because I think the biggest misunderstanding about personal growth isn't that we don't chase it hard enough, it's that we've convinced ourselves it's something we do for ourselves, and only for ourselves. I want to spend the next 20 minutes making the case to you that it never was. Let's get into it. Thank you for choosing Passion Struck and choosing me to be your host and guide on your journey to creating an intentional life that matters. Now, let that journey begin. There's an old parable I've carried with me for years. You may have already heard some version of it. And if you have, stay with me, because I don't think we've actually gotten to the real lesson in it yet. And if you haven't heard it, good. Just let it happen to you. Picture a small hospital room. No decoration, no view worth mentioning. Two beds close enough that the men could hear each other breathing at night. Both were seriously ill. Both had been there for months. And both knew, without saying it out loud, that they might not be leaving. One bed sat next to the room's only window. The man in it had a lung condition that required him to be propped upright for exactly 1 hour every afternoon to help drain the fluid from his chest. For that 1 hour, he could see outside. The other man couldn't. His illness kept him flat on his back around the clock. He couldn't even turn his head far enough to catch the daylight on the wall. So, every afternoon, at the same hour, the man by the window would ease himself up, look out through that glass, and start talking. He described a park just beyond the hospital grounds. Kids chasing each other across the grass. A mother pushing a stroller. An old man throwing bread to pigeons. He described a lake past the park, with a pair of white swans gliding across it like they had nowhere else to be. He described couples walking arm in arm under trees just starting to bloom. On clear days, he said he could see all the way to a stretch of water where sailboats leaned into the wind, and past that, a skyline that caught fire every evening when the sun went down. Every detail, every single day. The color of the light, whether the swans had come back yet, what the kids were playing that afternoon. And the man, flat on his back, started living for that hour. It became the best part of his day. Some days, the only part worth getting through the rest of the day for. He'd lie there in the mornings, already looking forward to it. He built the whole outside world in his mind from another man's voice, one afternoon at a time. Then, one night, without warning, the man by the window died in his sleep. The next morning, once the staff had come and gone, the surviving man made a request. Could he be moved to the window bed? The nurses saw no reason to say no. They shifted him over, got him settled, and left him there alone. And for the first time in months, with real effort, real pain, he pushed himself up on one elbow and turned his head toward that window himself. And there was a blank brick wall. That's it. No park, no lake, no swans. There was only a man who, in the middle of his own suffering, decided to build a world of hope for somebody else. I used to think this story was about kindness. I don't anymore. I think it's about something bigger. The man by the window didn't just tell stories. His inner life became someone else's environment. The second man wasn't listening to words. He was living inside another person's imagination. And look, that's not a rare story. It's an ordinary one because it's happening right now today in your house. Not in hospital rooms, in kitchens, in marriages, in boardrooms. We like to tell ourselves our stress belongs to us. Our resentment belongs to us. Our insecurity belongs to us. It doesn't. It moves through us. It becomes the air other people breathe. So let's get back to where we started. Who benefits if you never evolve? At first, it feels like the answer is me. But that's only true if you imagine you're living alone. And none of us truly are. Every time you refuse to heal, someone else inherits the wound. Every time you choose to heal, someone else inherits the hope. Take a moment and let that sit with you. We're going to take a short break for our sponsors. While you listen, ask yourself, what version of me actually walked into my house yesterday? When we return, I'm going to share a piece of my own story and the exact trap that kept me exporting my stress to my family for years without even realizing it. We'll be right back. Thank you for supporting those who support the show. You're listening to Passion Struck right here on the Passion Struck Network. Welcome back. If you're joining us, we've been exploring why personal growth was never meant to be a private project. When I left off, we realized that our inner world becomes the weather everyone around us walks through. And I want to get very real about what happens when we ignore that weather. I wish I could tell you understanding this changed me overnight. It didn't. Honestly, I still catch myself falling into that exact same trap. For decades, I lived inside a story that felt completely noble, climbing through the ranks in the military, and later working 8 hours a week as a corporate executive. I told myself, I'm doing this for my family. I treated my internal state like a private bill that only I was paying. I thought I was providing a lifestyle. I was actually exporting a climate. Just like the man by that hospital window, I was shaping the room. The difference is, I had no idea what I was bringing into it. I do now. It looked like my family, learning to read the room before I even said hello. Conversations getting shorter, because nobody wanted to accidentally set me off. My kids going quiet the second I sat down, trying to figure out which version of Dad had just walked in. My intentions were loving, but my family wasn't living inside my intentions. They were living inside my nervous system. And here's the part that took me way too long to understand. I didn't even realize I was doing it. Seriously, I thought I was being a great provider. Then, earlier this week, I sat down with Jess Ekstrom, and she gave the whole thing a name. The arrival trap. It's the belief that success is always just around the corner. That once you hit the next number, the next title, the next milestone, you finally feel the way you want to feel. Jess pointed me to some research out of Vanderbilt on when our brains actually release dopamine. You'd assume it's the reward itself, the raise, the promotion that gives you the hit. Nope. The spike happens in anticipation of the result, not at the result, which means the moment you've been white-knuckling toward almost never delivers what you told yourself it would. Just put it in words we've all said to ourselves. Once I get through this month, I can relax. Once I hit this number, I'll feel safe. Once I live in this neighborhood, I'll feel like I made it. And the second you arrive, you're already reaching for the next quote-unquote once I. You train yourself to delay joy indefinitely, and you drag the people who love you into the waiting room of your life along with you. I'd actually gone into a conversation with Arthur Brooks already thinking about this. I'd read something he'd written about, a reverse bucket list, and I wanted him to walk me through it. So I asked him, Arthur, why is a normal bucket list, the thing everyone's supposed to want, actually working against us? He looked at me and he said, John, real satisfaction isn't about how much you have. It's about how much you have divided by how much you want. You get the raise, satisfaction ticks up for a minute. Then your brain resets. Your wants quietly expand to match your new haves. And you're right back where you started, just at a higher altitude. Social scientists call it the hedonic treadmill. You can feel it speed up every time that's amazing turns into, okay, but what's next? That was exactly the trap I was living in. I thought I was managing my stress. Looking back, I was hiding behind my performance, betting that the next achievement would finally let me exhale and let my family exhale with me. So here's what Arthur actually does with that reverse bucket list. On his birthday, instead of writing down everything he still wants, he writes down the wants that have quietly been running his life. More followers, more money, more influence, and he crosses them out one at a time. Not because he'll never want those things again, because he's decided in advance he'll be fine without them. He told me it moves the want out of the reactive animal part of the brain and into the part that can actually think something through. You don't stop being ambitious. You just stop needing the outcome to feel okay. Since that conversation, I've started doing my own version of that list. And honestly, it's the closest thing I've found to turning down the climate I export at home. Because the once-I list and the reverse bucket list cannot both run your nervous system at the same time. One keeps you reaching past the room you're standing in. The other actually lets you be in it. Your family doesn't need your next achievement. They need the sanctuary of your presence. There's a second version of this trap, and it doesn't come from ambition at all. It comes from a number. Talking with Guy Kawasaki yesterday, we got into what happens once human worth starts getting measured by things like likes, followers, and engagement, and what that does to a kid who gets handed a phone before they're even 10. I threw out my theory that technology is amplifying people's fear that they don't matter. Guy pushed back, and I think he was right to. He didn't think tech was amplifying the fear of not mattering. He thought it was quietly rewriting what mattering even means. For a lot of young people now, mattering means followers. Guy told me flat out, he'd take 15 or 20 genuinely good friends over 15 million followers any day of the week, even though he himself has a few million. Sit with that for a second, because it's a bigger deal than it sounds. If mattering gets redefined as something you broadcast, the version of you that's actually in the room stops being the point. The performance is the point. You stop asking, am I here with the people in front of me? And start asking, how's this landing with everyone who isn't? Near the end of our conversation, I asked Guy the really big question I had on my mind the entire interview. What actually makes a life meaningful? Not fame, not net worth, not your name on a building. He said it plainly, you leave the world a little better than you found it. For other people, not for yourself. That's the whole test. Line that up next to the arrival trap and the reverse bucket list, and they're all pointing at the same thing from three different angles. The room in front of you, your family, your team, the people who actually live with your presence, can never outcompete an audience you can't see. If you let it, the broadcast always wins because it's louder and it never stops asking for more. But the broadcast doesn't inherit your nervous system. The people in the room do. At this point, fair question. John, this is a nice idea, but does what's going on inside me actually change the physical reality of the people around me? Here's where it stops being a metaphor. For 85 years, Harvard has been asking one question. What actually makes a good life? The Harvard Study of Adult Development has followed hundreds of people across their entire lives. And when I asked the study's director, Dr. Bob Waldinger, what surprised his own team the most, it wasn't the finding about health habits. Everyone expected that one. It was that our connections with other people help determine how long and how well we actually live. Warmer relationships predicted lower rates of disease later in life and longer lives, period. It surprised his team so much they didn't believe the data at first. They spent years afterward just trying to figure out how a relationship could physically get inside a body and change the way it runs. One thread from that conversation has stuck with me. Loneliness. It's this deeply personal thing. You can feel lonely in a full house or perfectly content living alone on a mountain, but it's turned out to be one of the strongest predictors of health we have. People who feel more isolated than they want to be show worse mental and physical health, and their brains actually decline sooner. It's common enough that the UK actually appointed a government minister for loneliness. And Waldinger made a point of telling me it doesn't spare anyone. A Gallup survey he cited found that roughly half of all CEOs reported feeling lonely. I know I felt it myself when I was a CEO. It reaches every level of a life, no matter how full that life looks like from the outside. Think about that for a second. The mood you walk into a room with doesn't stay inside you. Everybody else in that room starts carrying it too. That's not a nice sentiment. It's a measurable health input in both directions. There's one additional piece from Waldinger that I haven't been able to shake. Many of the original men in that Harvard study went off to fight in World War II, and a lot of them came home with what we'd now call PTSD. Things like nightmares, flashbacks, with no way to talk about what they'd seen. But the study found that the ones with good marriages and close friendships, they were buffered from the worst long-term damage that trauma and war does. Warm relationships didn't just make people happier, they changed how trauma actually lived in the body. So here's where I want to land on this. Your present isn't just felt, it's absorbed. When you're chronically wound up, stretched thin, checked out, that doesn't stay contained inside your own head. It becomes part of the actual physical environment the people under your roof are living in. And when you do the work, things like regulating your own nervous system, face what you've been avoiding, show up present instead of performing, you're not just improving yourself. You're handing the people you love something closer to a sanctuary, a place where their bodies can finally put the guard down and rest. So let's go back to the beginning and the question I asked when we started. Who do I want to become? Here's what I know now that I didn't know when I first asked it. Long before I ever figured out who I was becoming, I was already becoming someone else's environment. That was happening whether I was paying attention to it or not. It's happening to you right now, whether you're paying attention to it or not, which finally answers the question underneath all of this we've discussed today. Who benefits if I never evolve? Nobody. Not one person in your life gets a better deal if you stay stuck. Not your kids, not your team, not your wife, not even the version of yourself that thinks it's protecting itself by staying the same. And who benefits the moment you actually do the work? Everybody standing in the room with you. The man beside the hospital window never changed the world outside. He couldn't take down that brick wall. He couldn't cure his own illness. But every single afternoon, he changed the world inside that room. That's what every one of us is doing. Every day, whether we mean to or not, your inner life walks into every room before you ever say a word. So here's what I'll leave you with. What kind of environment are you for the people you share your life? Because whether you've thought about it or not, you're already answering that question. One small way to put that into practice today. If today's conversation made you think differently about technology, privacy, or what it means to flourish in the modern world, share it with someone who'd get something out of it. Personal recommendations are still the best way that these conversations find new listeners. And if you'd like to keep exploring these ideas, follow Passionstruck on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, subscribe to the Passionstruck YouTube channel, and download this week's companion workbook through the Ignited Life on Substack. Everything you need is linked in today's show notes. Next week, I'm joined by one of the most innovative coaches in America, Sean Brosnan. And Sean built one of the greatest high school cross-country programs in history, producing national champions, Olympians, and athletes who rewrote the record books. But what fascinated me wasn't his training philosophy. It was his belief that the biggest limits we face are rarely physical. They're mental. In our conversation, Sean explains why most people dramatically underestimate what they're capable of, how belief becomes a competitive advantage, why culture always beats talent, and what it actually takes to build a life or a team that consistently performs beyond what anyone thought was possible. Whether you're leading a company, raising a family, building a career, or simply trying to become a better version of yourself, I think you'll hear your own story in this conversation. I can't wait to share it with you.
I think everyone has their own individual reasons of why they're going to run or flourish or do well. I think there's some people that are super competitive and they hate losing, and that's an attribute, and sometimes it can hinder you too. I just think there's all different reasons of why. As a coach, it's like your job to find that individual is. The biggest thing I always say in my coaching, and I think in coaching in general, is it's all individualized, and people are like, yeah, I do that, but they don't. Everybody's different and everyone's going to react to different things.
Until then, remember, the life you leave behind will always be shaped by the life you choose to live today. I'm John Miles, and until next time, live passion struck.